Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey, and joining me today we have two guests, Bob Mackey.
Hello, everybody. How's it going?
How you doing, Bob?
I'm good.
And we have a returning guest, came on to talk about that excellent Final Fantasy XII localization feature that he did for us a couple months ago, John Learned. Welcome back.
Hey, everybody. How are you?
So, don't sound so excited. Jeez.
Oh, I'm psyched.
I can tell. Exactly. Today we're going to be talking about a lot of things. There's been quite a bit of news. We've got the Bloodborne DLC, which is why I've got you two on the show. And, of course, the Final Fantasy VII Remake news, because there's been quite a bit on that front, actually, so it's worthwhile revisiting it for an update. And we'll wrap up with Ni No Kuni sequel news, which I think Bob has a few thoughts on that one, so... Let's get right started with the Final Fantasy VII Remake update. Some interesting things over the weekend during Sony's PlayStation Experience keynote. We got a gameplay trailer, which I cannot say that I was expecting at this early of a date. It seems like Square Enix was looking to maybe put to rest some doubts that they were actually going to make this game.
Well, I mean, technically Kingdom Hearts 3 has a gameplay trailer, so...
This is a fact,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Versus 13 had a gameplay trailer at 1.2.
But at the same time, like, how long did it take... Well, how long did it take Versus 13 to even get a gameplay trailer? It took several years, right?
They had some sort of gameplay trailer, like a Japanese-only show, years and years ago. It was... Kingdom Hearts like combat in like a city street, so I don't know.
Was that like 2006?
Something like that. Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
God. So yeah, it's not necessarily given that this is anything but pre-rendered footage, proof of concept kind of stuff. And just based on their comments, it kind of sounded like they were going, well, we're still working on a lot of things. We're still coming up with a lot of stuff. So it's not necessarily like this is finished gameplay, but it was clear that they have something. And not only do they have something, it actually looked pretty good. You know, I liked the style. I liked it. It felt faithful to Final Fantasy VII. What did you guys think?
I'm not sure what to think about it until I'm absolutely positive it is real gameplay. I mean, it could be like a mock-up of gameplay. Whenever I hear like actual gameplay, all I think is like, okay, it's not pre-rendered. That's all that means to me. So I'm a little jaded, I guess, at this point.
No, I totally agree. I think what they've shown to me looks like basically what they've been doing with Final Fantasy XV, like with how Noctis kind of weaves in between small spaces and crawls under rocks. It looks like they took exactly what they were doing from that and just sort of repainted some character assets and kind of mocked up a battle scene. I mean, I could be way off base with that, but I want it to look something like that personally. I mean, if they're going to do the action RPG route, I think it's probably their safest bet was making it probably Kingdom Hearts-like, because they already have an idea of how that combat's going to work. But until I know for sure that that's it, I don't want to seem too skeptical, but I guess I'll believe it when they say this is it for real.
Yeah, I think it was somebody, I'm not sure where, but I saw somebody commenting that the cloud model looks a lot like a slightly updated lightning model, which is why the arms are so skinny. But
I've seen people talking about how this version of Cloud looks emaciated and sickly, which would make sense given the setting and his place in this timeline, I guess. So it could have narrative reasons behind it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense in context. And somebody pointed out that in one of the real version CGI cutscenes, the one where Cloud is with Eris, that his arms are pretty skinny on that one, too. So they could just be trying to be as faithful as possible to the original art style, which, given where Nomura's art kind of went post-Final Fantasy VII, that's not necessarily a bad thing. So a couple of other items. Okay, so we might as well discuss the battle system right now. I think we discussed this ages ago. It's obvious that Jeremy was right. they were not going with the original turn-based strategy approach. It made me a little sad that they're not going strictly turn-based, but I understand the impulse to actually update the combat.
Right. And I don't want to discount Jeremy's thoughts and predictions, but I feel like with a project of this magnitude, they would never go turn-based just because they don't want to scare people away from something that they're probably spending a lot of money on.
Yes, mass market is definitely the thing. But the thing that kind of gave me hope was they, in an interview with Famitsu, I think it was Kitase, said that he was going for a much more tactical bent, and it was not a hack. They were not planning on making it a hack and slash kind of game like Kingdom Hearts or even Dissidia, and that they're implementing the active time battle bar somehow, though they didn't elaborate, which lends further credence to the idea that this is a mock-up, because you totally didn't see an ATB bar anywhere on that screen. And it looked kind of Crisis Core-ish, if I do say so myself. And it also made me happy that you control all three party members, or that you have three members in your party. I assume that two of them are controlled by the AI, but you can switch between them. And I'm kind of wondering if, like, you can pause and decide what move you're going to make, a la traditional Western RPG. In any case, it's going to be really different, which not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I mean, I think Final Fantasy VII was very much built around the expectations of an audience in 1997, and the remake is built around the expectations of an audience in 2015 or 2017 or whenever it comes out. It's just, like, it's not a straight, like, you know, it's not just a refurbishment. I think it's, like, a reimagining.
Well, we talked about this in a podcast where we deliberately tackled turn-based battles and that kind of thing, and I don't remember exactly the kind of consensus that we came to, but it is disappointing that turn-based, for some reason, like, people are allergic to turn-based combat, and that is somehow not mass market. I don't know. I prefer it. So.
I dare say it wasn't even mass market in 1997, and I believe I told this anecdote on that episode, but the common takeaway from people that I knew who bought Final Fantasy VII based on the commercials was, you can't even move your guys. That was a common complaint, like, I can't move my guys. So even in 1997, that defied expectations. So yeah, it does feel like an incredibly modern move to dispose of that, even though I like turn-based stuff.
What are your thoughts, John?
No, I agree. I like turn-based stuff a lot, but Bob's right. Like, it took something like a Final Fantasy VII for turn-based combat, I think, to be somewhat mainstream, and that those were just the expectations of the time. So Square's got to make money on this, and if making money means making it an action RPG with real-time combat, then that's the way they're going to do it. I mean, not to jump too far ahead, but with the way that they're making it episodic, or at least implying that, like, that seems to me that they need to make money off of this pretty quickly for the scope that they're going for. So if making combat that way is going to help them kind of achieve that without crippling their company, then that's what they're going to do.
Well, they're outsourcing the hell out of this thing, too.
I'm sure.
That is true. And I totally forget, pardon my ignorance, but is this a Tetsuya Nomura production?
Oh, it's a
Yes,
Nomura
he is. Okay. He's directing, technically.
I brought this up on another podcast, so apologies for, again, repeating myself, but I feel like the deal was like, okay, you can't ship a console game. We figured that out over the past 10 years. Maybe you can ship four smaller games. So I feel like they're working, because they can't possibly fire him in any way because of how, you know, Japanese business works. So I think
he's in too deep.
Yeah, exactly. He's in too deep. So I think they're trying to negotiate on his terms. Like, what can we make this guy commit to in order to actually have a product on the shelves?
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think part of it is, or the bigger part is straight up money. I think Yoichi Wada a couple years ago came right out and said, look, if we were to remake this game for a modern console, and this was like during the PS3, Xbox 360 era, this would bankrupt our company for the expectations that everybody has. And the only way I think they're going to be able to pull that off is that, like, they release an episode, recoup some of the cost, release another episode, and I'm sure Nomura's working pace has a lot to do with that too. But
I kind of buy that, but I think it really is tied up in Nomura, because I see things like Xenoblade Chronicles X being this like 120-hour masterpiece, and I don't think the scope of Final Fantasy VII is really that big compared to some of our modern open-world RPGs. But I do think they're being very accommodating of the kind of production this is and the talent they're working with.
Talent involved, yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
I think, hot take time, I really despise the fact that this is going to be episodic. I think, I think it's going to totally break up the flow. They're going to pad the hell out of each episode. Like, they might go, okay, well, part one is all in Midgar, and you're going to spend all of your time exploring Midgar, and we're going to, like, add all of these new elements, and it's going to be a bit more open world. I'm like, yeah, fine, okay, but I like a good, coherent story, and I'm not sure that it's going to necessarily work in an episodic context. It's going to really take me out of the flow of the story, and not only that, it's going to be probably really expensive. I mean, we could be talking about a game that's upwards of over $100 when you get it all together. And just by having these really defined splits, I feel like you're going to like really hurt the sense of you exploring this big world and having this big story, right? Like, even if I play it one after the other, it feels like it's going to lose something in the translation. It feels like I'm not going to have as much freedom to explore the world. I'm not seeing it necessarily. Maybe they can prove me wrong. Obviously, I'll go with an open mind. I like their ambition for the game, but I don't know if I can even be engaged for the time period that they're probably going to be talking about. I mean, this game could be released over the period of like 2 years. I mean, yeah. Who even knows how long this thing is going to take? You know what it reminds me of? I was just thinking. It reminds me of the current OVA system with anime.
Yeah, I was thinking of like the Evangelion remake movies.
Just for like context, Gundam Unicorn started in like 2011 or 2010. And it didn't finish until, like, last year. That's, like, 4 years. And each episode was, like, an hour. And it's, like, I followed along with it, but thinking about, like, the way media is consumed, if, like, that's the route they're going, where it's, like, well, we're going to release an episode, like, every year, or, like, two episodes a year or something, like, isn't it a bit much to ask people to follow a single game for, like, a course of, like, 2 years?
I mean, we'll see, but... I totally agree. The last two experiences I had with episodic Final Fantasy games did not go well. It was Final Fantasy IV The After Years and Final Fantasy Dimensions, and in neither case did I pursue more than the first episode. And yeah, it could just be because those episodes weren't very good, but I do feel like they were a little hamstrung by their episodic approach, where it's like, well, we can't give you a full experience, but here's a crappy dungeon you can go through a bunch of times, you know? That'll be fun, right?
I can't even lock in long enough to finish a Telltale season. And those were released like one after another, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, we'll see. This is all expected. I don't mind them taking a new take on the battle system. The mock-up or whatever the heck that was that they showed at PSX is Well, it looks faithful to the original, at least. It doesn't seem like they're straying too far from the spirit of the original. So I guess we'll have to see, and also hope that this thing kicks off by 2017. I have faith. I have faith that they're going to get it out for the 20th anniversary of Final Fantasy VII.
I really want to see how Kate Sith, or as you should say,
Ketchi. Yes,
yeah, Ketchi is depicted in this game, because that was one of the goofiest ass things. Even in 97, like, okay, so there is a puppet riding a giant doll, and that's one of my characters. Okay.
Totally normal.
Yeah. I want to see how they try to sell that concept with photorealistic graphics, or if they just dispose of it entirely.
Nah, I think they'll keep Ketchi around, because people will, like, completely throw a fit if they get rid of Ketchi.
And they will give him, a really strong Irish accent, which I think they've done with, like, Dissidia and things like that, or... I don't know. Like, at some point, I've seen that character with a strong Irish brogue.
I mean, first of all, it's not photorealistic. It's heavily stylized, as True. We've already seen in the trailer.
But it's more than the papercraft, FF7 polygonal models.
And second of all, it can't be any weirder than Teddy from Persona 4.
Yeah, I guess so. Although that is a drawing, and you kind of give that more leeway, I think.
Yeah, that's way more stylized too, like the cel shaded graphics and the sort of anime cutscenes in the Persona games. I think that gives it a little bit more. We can cut Teddy a little bit more slack that way, but when we can see every pore on Barrett's arm,
yeah.
I think she's going to look kind of wacky. But I think what we're talking about ultimately is that some of us are going to find that stuff really weird, and other people are going to be fine with it. But ultimately, somebody is going to be pissed off about this game one way or another, and that I don't mean to sound very dramatic or contrarian here, but I never really thought this was such a great idea, and now that we're finding out that it's going to be episodic and the combat's going to be changed, we're like this is the ground zero for when the uproar really starts, I think.
Oh yeah, I played through the game again in 2013 when I was unemployed, and that's when you play these RPGs again, of course.
Right.
And I was just like totally smitten by how they really stuck to these weird ideas that didn't look or play out that well in 32-bit graphics, but they still like were interesting and just compelling to watch. Like you visit a haunted house and all the crazy things happening in the chocobo races, and you know, just like all these weird touches that you would never see in a modern Final Fantasy game, that they are just clinging to their kind of 16-bit ideas, but interpreting them in a different way.
Yeah, I think they were sort of finding their way, though. I mean,
for sure. Yeah, they were making it up as they went along.
Right.
I totally agree.
When I tried to play Final Fantasy VII like a decade ago, I think the reason that I wanted them to remake it originally was because I thought that even in 2002, it looked really, really rough and hadn't aged well even by then. And so I was like, oh, I really love Final Fantasy VII, and I want to experience again, but I want modern graphics. And I suppose the only disappointing thing is that whatever they're making is definitely not what I played originally, which, fine, okay, yeah, give me something new, it's cool. I think the main thing originally for me in wanting a remake was that I just wanted something that looked a little more modern, but stuck to what was the original. I have very conflicting feelings about this project. We shall see. It feels appropriate, actually, given that Star Wars is coming out next week, which is another nostalgia project. This is like the ultimate nostalgia project right here.
Well, the sad truth is, and this is not an original statement, but we are basically what the baby boomers were in the 90s. We are being placated and pandered to, and we are being reminded of the things that we loved, and now that we have money, we can buy them all over again. So the 90s
great?
Have never died. It's like Portlandia up in here.
I mean, just look at anime, for God's sake. Like, you have your mass market stuff, and then you've got you're basically got a drip feed of nostalgia for people who watched anime in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Here, have your $100 anime Blu-ray with an hour and a half of content. Enjoy. Well, and check back in 6 months so you get something new.
And it's
anyway.
True, even more mainstream forms of entertainment, like Mr. Show is back and Mystery Science Theater is coming back. Like, this is not exclusive to video games at all. You're totally right.
This has been happening for kind of a long time. So yeah. The way that we consume media now is totally different than what it was 10 years ago. So, of course, all that stuff is going to come back to kind of draw on the people that got the money, you know, the post-Gen X, I guess, whatever generation you and I or everybody falls into, but...
But in the Kickstarter era, it's been kicked into overdrive because now...
In the teeth.
Now all the people who, like, well, we couldn't make this before because it wasn't mass market are coming out of the woodwork to be like, look, come finance your, like, particular niche, your very, 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 very narrow niche, and we don't even have to worry about how well it's going to ultimately do because you're going to give us... You're assuming all the risk. You're assuming all the risk by giving us the money ahead of time. It's fine.
Yeah, and in an article I wrote today, like, I think most of the games that were announced, the surprising games of 2015, like Shenmue 3 and Red Ash and Koji Igarashi's Castlevania spiritual successor, they are all drawing off of things that we loved to play in the 90s.
I didn't even like playing Shenmue in the 90s.
Well, I'm not saying I did either, but somebody did, and they want to
pay
for it again.
Shenmue 3, now there's a game that is not coming out.
It has to, I think.
No,
like,
it's not.
Legally.
It's not going to happen. I'm staking. It's not happening. I'm sorry. I mean, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, for God's sake.
I've been saying that about a Final Fantasy VII remake for years, though.
I've said this before, but when was the last time Yu Suzuki even made a game? I want to believe. I'm sure that he'll have plenty of help.
But this is not a Shenmue podcast, and Shenmue is not an RPG, but I feel like he is in the position where he is no longer a George Lucas figure that no one can say no to, and that is the best situation for him, because people needed to say no to him a lot with Shenmue 1 and 2.
All right, we're straying a little far afield here. There was a bunch of stuff announced at PSX. Lots of good Japanese news, actually. Yakuza 0 is coming out here. Not really an RPG per se, more of a open world brawler thing with
I will argue
adventure.
With you, I started playing Yakuza 5 last night, and I was reminded, like, yes, Yakuza is an RPG. There are random battles, there are experience points, there are skills. Like, there is nothing in this game that isn't an RPG.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, I totally believe that. That's my argument, and I hope it makes you mad.
But they're pretty light.
They are, but
considered.
I mean, we call much lesser things RPGs, like Costume Quest and, like, Child of Light, like, things that are just barely touching that kind of substance.
Well, this is the topic that we've been talking about since literally episode one. What
exactly
is an RPG, and does it really matter? Who cares? But
it doesn't matter, but I will say Yakuza is an RPG series for sure.
Good news that Yakuza 0 is in fact coming out here. I think a lot of people did not think it would be coming out. It's a Yakuza prequel set in the 1980s, which...
So it feels like it's doing what Shenmue should have did.
I mean, Yakuza is basically the spiritual successor to Yakuza, to Shenmue, right? I mean, it basically is Shenmue.
I've never played a Yakuza game. I can't comment on any of this.
Oh, you should totally play
it.
Yeah, you should totally play Yakuza, John.
Yeah, I mean, it's Shenmue, but it's like, what if we gave you game-like things to do in an open world? Not just like, you can appreciate this world just for being open, but in Yakuza, it's like, let's give you, you know, activities and, like, goals and things like that.
But what if I like lousy part-time jobs and forklifting?
What if I like getting an allowance from my mother at age 23 or whatever?
Yeah.
Also, Ni no Kuni 2 was announced at PSX. Fairly surprising. Was it announced already? Did I miss something? I'm pretty sure that's
news. I think that was PSX where it was first revealed. Or yeah.
I mean, that's surprising. Surprising, A, that it exists. Because I always figured that Level 5 would be like, well, that was an interesting partnership with Ghibli. Did not go as well as we had hoped. We had hoped they had obviously hoped to make like a mega hit, and they got a pretty successful game. And more surprising even still that it was revealed here rather than say at TGS. Am I missing something?
I'm under the impression that Ni no Kuni did much better in the US on the PS3 than it did
in Japan. Same here.
It got a greatest hits re-release. We never even saw the DS version in the U.S., so I'm not too shocked about this. I like the Final Fantasy VII remake. I just hope it's good, but I don't think we should be really too surprised that something like this may have crept around the corner eventually.
Yeah. Well, I recently wrote about it today, and I got a ton of comments, which I love just reading. Even people disagree with me, but I feel like the PS3 game was hamstrung because it was really a little too based on the DS game, and they ported over a lot of elements and systems that didn't really make sense on a console. So I feel like breaking free from that baggage will make the sequel better, I hope. And I think Level 5 is much better at making RPGs. Like, Yo-Kai Watch feels like it corrects a lot of mistakes that Ni No Kuni made, because Ni No Kuni was a very similar game in that it was a very much Pokemon-ish experience where you're collecting monsters and leveling them up and, you know, going for the ones you want. And I feel like Yo-Kai Watch did that in a much better way and a much more satisfying way.
Level 5's always been sort of a company that chases the one mechanic that's popular. And I think Ni No Kuni, the first Ni No Kuni, really fell into that because Pokemon was still a pretty big thing at the time. And, you know, if you look back at their catalog, like White Knight Chronicles is basically just a Monster Hunter on PS3.
That's right. And Dark Cloud was called the Zelda Killer.
But
not by Level 5. I think PlayStation Magazine called it that.
And it's like, it's much as a Zelda game as it is like about you're being a steamboat captain. But I'm really hoping that they sort of ditch that monster collecting mechanic for the second one, to be honest with you. I like Level 5 when they do their own thing and they just build interesting RPGs on their own. So I'm really hoping it doesn't have that recruiting. And if it does, I at least just hope it's better than what it was the first time around.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that they found that in Yo-Kai Watch, like the perfect, well, not perfect, but their best interpretation of that, which I assume has improved over the sequels that we haven't gotten. But in Ni No Kuni, that was the most, it was the worst part of that game, just because it necessitated so much grinding, so much wasted time, that it really ruined the game for me.
What was the actual mechanic in the original Ni No Kuni?
Well, you would, it had a battle system that was somewhat action-based, but it was still random, they weren't even random encounters, I'm sorry, but there was just a slim chance.
They were essentially random because you really couldn't avoid an enemy on the world map coming after you.
Yeah. But like you always, there's a random chance you could recruit whatever monsters you just fought, kind of thing. So it wasn't really too deep, but there weren't really a whole lot of skills or other factors that could sort of boost the recruitment rate. So let's say you're trying to recruit really rare stuff or really difficult monsters, you're sitting there for hours just banging your head against the wall.
Yeah, it's like that in Yo-Kai Watch too, unfortunately. But
really?
you can game the system a little bit. Also in Ni No Kuni, I believe to level up your monsters or to increase their skills, you'd have to like feed them through a pet mini game.
And that took forever.
Yeah, you had to feed them like one item at a time and watch the entire animation play out over. Like it would be like I would be in that menu for upwards of 15 minutes just feeding my monsters and thinking like, this is not fun. Why can't I feed you like more than one item at once? I don't need to see you eat the ice cream. I believe it. I believe you're doing that.
Ni No Kuni really seemed to touch a nerve here in the US. It may be the same nerve that Bravely Default did, which was to say, oh, a big budget JRPG. Yes, I want it. Thank you. Even if it isn't kind of what I would necessarily want, or it's not really in line with your with the traditional turn-based experience. I mean, it has a certain look, a certain pedigree, it's on a console rather than a handheld, not to disparage handhelds, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what made it a real RPG for people, unfortunately. And I kind of disagree with your Bravely Default analogy, because I feel like people only cared about this because it was a big-budget JRPG on a console. When Ni No Kuni released, it was 2013, and the 3DS was getting so many great RPGs. Like, we had... I think Fire Emblem for the 3DS like launched a month later or something like that. So we were not... It wasn't like we were like in a dry spell. And I believe Xenoblade just released that summer, too, in America. So I don't know. I feel like there was a certain level of production values that made this a real game in some people's eyes that kind of disappointed me, you know? Like, I feel like all of the essays, like, the JRPG is back. I was like, but it never went anywhere. You just only care if it looks really good.
I think that you're probably right on that front. And you're right, like, the Bravely Default... I think Bravely Default caught people's attention in the way that it did, mostly because it was really old school, but also really deep.
Right. And I believe that game is, it's like, it's a beautiful game with lavish production values and an amazing soundtrack, but it's still not on that console level that will make people stand up and take notice, unfortunately.
So what are your hopes for Ni No Kuni 2?
I'm hoping, again, that Level 5 learns what they did from Yo-Kai Watch, which is essentially Ni No Kuni, but much more streamlined. And I'm hoping that the micromanagement is cut down. And I feel like without that DS baggage, this can be a much better game. Because if you remember correctly, the DS game shipped with this book that was full of these spells that you would have to consult to actually draw them into the screen. And that was a huge part of that game and part of the main appeal, part of the gimmick. But for the PS3 version of Ni No Kuni, when you were casting those spells that would, like, you know, they were part of, like, plot-related quests and things like that, all you would do is, like, choose them from a drop-down menu on the TV screen. So, like, I feel like part of the problem with the PS3 Ni No Kuni was they didn't think hard enough about how to make that DS game a console game. So, since this is a console game from the very beginning, I feel like they're starting from the right place.
John?
I want them to basically just start over from scratch. Like, I respect what they tried to do with the first game, but I just want something maybe evolved from the combat that they had, because it was simple, but it was fun. But I don't really think the monster recruiting mechanic is really going to do them any favors anymore.
You're right about that. And it's the same as it is in Yo-Kai Watch, when it should be... You're kind of like just waiting to get lucky to get the monster you
right.
want,
yeah, exactly.
basically. And I dislike that. I want to be more actively recruiting these things instead of like, oh, now, my eighth battle, I finally got this thing.
Right. Like, if they're going to have recruitable monsters, I hope it's not just like a random chance in combat. Like, give us something a little bit more meaty to do. But actually, kind of the opposite of what you were going with, Bob, the way that they shipped the book with the DS version, just that's a really old PC Apple II kind of thing to do, and I really wish we would have got that in the US, because it's such a cool idea, and I kind of want them
I do too. Like, if we only got that version with the book, I'd be totally happy, and I'd probably
absolutely
get a lot more out of it.
Yeah, and I would sort of like to see them double down on that idea. I don't think it's going to happen, but I don't know. I just want a good, solid build of what they've already been, what they had already done with the first Ni No Kuni, but I just want them to ditch the random monster recruitment.
All right, time to move on to the main event, Bloodborne DLC, which arrived. What was it? A couple weeks ago at this point.
God, time is moving so fast.
Two weeks? 3 weeks?
Might have been before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it was definitely before Thanksgiving.
So, John, you were really keen to be on this episode. You obviously have thoughts on the Bloodborne DLC, so I'd love to hear your perspective on it.
Okay. Well, first, I was absolutely satisfied with it. I thought it was great. I actually built a new character specifically for it and brought that new character into the DLC way before it was able to handle anything that I was running into. So I don't know about you, Bob, if you had like taken a pre-made character or made somebody new, but like the way you get into it is that you kill an early-ish boss, Vicar Amelia, and then you can sort of double back into the Hunter's Dream, get an item, and then sort of enter the DLC from there. It's a little puzzly.
It's not nearly as bad as it was in Dark Souls 1.
I've
seen people complain about it, and it's honestly not that bad. If you're into Bloodborne, you should be into the way you unlock this area.
Yeah. That is a stupid complaint, in my opinion. But anyway, so I walked into it pretty underleveled, thinking that, like, okay, I've heard this is hard. I've got two other characters that are way past New Game Plus, but I want to really just kind of soak this in for the first time. And it's hard, man. Those first starting areas they'll let you know right away whether you're able to hang with this stuff or not, and especially once you eventually make it to that first boss, it's pretty funky. But
it is, and I may get the lore wrong, and please crucify me if I do, but I believe this area is like it takes place in the past, maybe, or like a past version.
Yes. Ellipses? Question
okay, yes.
Mark?
So I'm not gonna commit to this, but what I found was really cool was the fact that the human enemies you fight in Bloodborne outside of the quote-unquote hunters are just like these brain-dead zombies that are like barely human and just sort of like grasping at the last threads of humanity and just lashing out at you, and they're really easy to fight. But in the DLC, it's the other way around. The humans have not completely lost their minds yet, and they're very formidable opponents. So throughout the first leg of this DLC, you're fighting nothing but like human opponents that are conceivably as smart as like another human player you would fight in the game.
But kind of, I'm going to slightly disagree with that, because like when you fight the actual human hunters in the game, they are way, way more difficult. They react faster, they'll back off of you when they need to heal and stuff like that. So I found the hunter opponents, especially early on, are a really good middle ground between the same quote-unquote hunters of the base game that
right.
they attack and release, they defend in very interesting ways, but they're not that smart, but they're certainly smarter than the average bear, I guess. Like
I do agree with you there. They're not as smart as the named hunters that will show up, but they are much more difficult than the standard humans or semi-humans you would fight towards the beginning of the game.
And there, some of them are way stronger than others, too. And the game doesn't tell you when that happens. So, like, when I finally got beefy enough to go in there and take on some of these guys, I was using Ludwig's Holy Blade, and I could stunlock them. And as long as I could get in, like, 4 or 5 hits, I could kill them without them touching me. And then you'd run into a situation where a random one of these hunters would pop out of nowhere, but his poise was through the roof, and you couldn't pull that stuff off on him. So it was really, you had to think situationally, and usually with Bloodborne and the Souls games too, you have to sort of like have a good command of the space around you and the environments, but like you can't just muscle through a lot of the enemies in these games, and these new hunter characters really teach you that pretty quickly if you've been getting into that habit.
The consensus seems to be that From Software is really good at making DLC. What is it about their DLC that like is so great?
Well, I feel that they use DLC as a way to address criticisms of the core game. It's not just like, oh, here's some extra stuff we wanted to put in the core game but couldn't fit it in. I feel like everything they've made past the release has been like, oh, you didn't want this or you wanted this? Well, we've solved that problem for you. So I feel like this DLC definitely, I don't know. I do feel like it addresses some core criticisms of the game, because it does give you a little more breathing room as far as customization. There are some items and weapons that take advantage of arcane and blood tinge builds more than you would find in the normal game. And it's just a more formidable challenge, I think, than anything in the core game. It's definitely the hardest, but I think the best section of Bloodborne is contained in the DLC.
I'd agree with that. Mostly with I was happier that they kind of addressed the way that builds work, and I actually made an arcane build specifically because I knew that the weapons like the Holy Moonlight Sword and stuff like that were probably going to be arcane based. So that's one of the things I really wanted to test. And one of the bigger kind of weirder criticisms about the game is that there just weren't enough weapons in it to begin with. And I've always kind of called that a little bit baloney, because even though there may be not as many weapons as like a Souls game, they're all practical and useful, but the DLC gives you tons of new stuff. I can't remember what the count was, but there's like 9 or 10 new weapons, which in scope of the base game, that's kind of a lot. So
yeah, because they all transform,
right?
Yeah.
And they're all pretty useful with a variety of builds. I mean, like certain stuff is obviously going to be better than others if you're skill or strength or whatever. But the DLC makes interesting weapons and kind of like rejiggers some of the environments to be fun and new. But I really think that the best part about it was just how it catapulted the difficulty way up in certain sections. And usually I'm not really a big fan of like make this harder, it makes it better, but like it really made you there were a lot of situations in the boss encounter specifically where like I had to think a little bit more tactically than twitch reflexy as I would in like the base game with some of the bosses. I don't know, Bob, what did you think about that?
Yeah, the difficulty was great because even like 6 years after playing Demon's Souls, there's nothing I like more than opening a shortcut in a From Software RPG. And that middle section of this DLC, which is like an abandoned like Bloodborne era hospital or like a ward, is just this intensely dense, packed building with all of these like secret passages and different staircases, and you're just constantly like making your way up, making progress, and unlocking stairways and elevators and things like that so you can make easier progress on a later attempt. And that is so intensely rewarding because it's a constant struggle because the enemies can take away like half of your health bar in one hit throughout the entire section. And I was over level for this section. I feel like this is like a pre-end game section of Bloodborne, even though you can access it much, much earlier than that.
And it was terrifying. That level was so creepy.
It totally evokes the Tower of Latria from Demon's Souls. And that was the mission statement from the director the entire time. Like, that is what we want to do with Bloodborne, evoke that atmosphere specifically. And this is the perfect expression of the Tower of Latria from Demon's Souls in this game. It feels like their version of it, actually.
Is that the one with the Cthulhu like mind flayers?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. My God, that one. Yeah. I walked in there and I died, and that was fun.
It was probably my least favorite level of that game, but
Wait, you like the Valley of Defilement more?
I think it's easier to handle, honestly, now that I've been through Demon's Souls.
I really hate the Valley of Defilement.
Oh, it's terrible, it's lousy, but I think from like the pure visual standpoint and art direction and what they were doing with the Tower of Latria, especially 3-2, that is creepy and weird.
Yeah, for sure.
John, you're kind of down on Bloodborne. I remember the last time we talked, you were kind of down on Bloodborne. Or that might be somebody else.
No.
Am I wrong? No, you're very high on Bloodborne.
Yes, there are things that I don't like about Bloodborne. I don't really like the Chalice Dungeons at all, but
I don't think anybody likes the Chalice Dungeons.
They're not god-awful. I just think they were a good idea implemented badly.
Yeah, I feel like you're not rewarded very well, and my friend Gary Butterfield has a podcast called Not Watch Out for Fireballs, but Bonfireside Chat, and he's been struggling with the dungeons to talk about them, and really the biggest problem is that your reward for beating a dungeon is access to another dungeon, which is a terrible cycle. You get certain named weapons here and there, but like they don't give you enough of an incentive to do these things that are often very, very much too hard.
Yeah, and like the only thing with those named weapons is that they're the exact same weapons you've already picked up, just with different gem loadouts. So it's really, I don't want to say your mileage is going to vary with that stuff because they're just not that worth it. But if you're really the kind of person that trophy hunts, you've got no choice but to get into the Chalice Dungeons, and there's really no other benefit to it.
And that should really teach you a lesson about the value of trophy
hunting. Trophies, right.
Yeah, like, you messed up. Don't do this.
But I love the base game. With a lot of the From Software stuff, especially Demon's Souls and the first Dark Souls, boss encounters were sort of gimmicky in that like there was always one specific way that you could really just barrel through a boss fight. Like the Tower Knight in Demon's Souls is a good example. You get around him, you hack his feet up, he'll fall over, a couple hits to the head, and it's done. And then in the first Dark Souls, the Taurus Demon, you could climb up on the battlement, you could fall on his head, outrun him, and just run back and do it all over again. Bloodborne takes all of that stuff away with its boss encounters, so essentially it makes it, it forces you to learn the fights instead of learn interesting ways to kill it and be safe about it. And I really like that about it, even though I'm kind of lousy at it. And it took a lot of work for me to get through some of those, and I think the online portions of Bloodborne weren't really as good as the previous game, so it was harder to kind of draw people into it, which, not to sidetrack, but that's another really good thing that they did with patch 1.07, I think, the newest one, where they put in AI characters in front of a lot of bosses in the base game that you can
call
in. They
did, yeah.
Which I think really solved a few problems, but the bosses are like you have to go toe to toe with most of them, and that makes the game really, really interesting and demanding on your skill. And I love that about it.
Yeah, one thing that I noticed about Bloodborne was even when I called in somebody to help, it wasn't necessarily a given that I would be able to take out a boss because you really have to be on your toes because it's quite possible that you're going to get wrecked by a boss in relatively short order. Even with even when you're double teaming them, it can become it's a fight. It's not a do this and then and then they're done and you're good. So, yeah, Bloodborne. what I've played of it, and I have not played as much as you guys, but I really enjoyed what I liked, what I played of it. It's, I hate using this word, it's a lot more streamlined than previous games in the series. It's definitely a different take, but I think in the end, its biggest strength, I suppose, is its atmosphere and it's just its general look. It's a really creepy game.
Yeah.
And it stands out in my memory. One of the things that I dislike about AAA games is so many of them just, it almost like they come from the big box of video game art tropes. And even games like The Witcher, which is a very attractive game, it's like, yes, we're going back to that typical fantasy look. Like, it's like they draw on a few buckets of different fantasy looks. And Dark Souls and Bloodborne just have this distinct look to them that I've always really enjoyed.
You know, now that we're talking about it, like, I think From Software sort of had to work their way into Bloodborne's aesthetic, because, like, Demon Souls and the first Dark Souls are very much kind of that dark fantasy thing, and, like, they certainly set a tone, but I think if most AAA developers, or not even AAA developers, if most developers went into a pitch meeting with a publisher and said, okay, we're going to do a weird H.P. Lovecraft faux Victorian horror game, action game, they would probably be laughed out of the room.
That's true, yeah.
I think they sort of had to, like, earn their place with doing something like that, and it totally paid off. I mean,
yeah, this game really doubles down on the Lovecraftian elements of the Dark Souls series to the point where I think it is actually the best Lovecraft game, period. Even though it does not cite him or mention him in any way, I feel like this is, if you like Lovecraft, that kind of horror, this game evokes that perfectly, more than any other explicit Lovecraft game.
Is it that big a risk to invoke Lovecraft in a video game, given how tightly video games have been tied toward the look and the monsters, and how so many, like, gamers are always going on about Cthulhu, etc., etc., etc.?
I think so, because the main appeal of Lovecraft is that the horror is indescribable, and knowing it and seeing it is so terrible that it drives you mad. So it's very hard to communicate visually what a Lovecraft thing should be, because it's supposed to be just, like, again, indescribable, and, like, your brain cannot comprehend the horrors that are being reflected at your eyes. So I think Bloodborne does an excellent job at that, just in terms of enemy design and boss design and using your knowledge of the world to seriously make your character lose his mind.
And I think, getting back to the DLC, they really get into that very well. Like, the way that a few of the bosses that you fight, the first one, Ludwig's the first one, right?
Right, yeah.
Ludwig and Vicar Lawrence, which is sort of kind of a secret boss of the DLC, they are named characters that sort of, like, the shadow of them are looming over the base game, but, like, when you actually see them and what they sort of evolved into, especially Ludwig, it's really terrifying. It's very bizarre, like, and it sort of ties into the lore with how they look. Like, Ludwig opens his mouth before the fight, and his mouth is covered with eyeballs, and it looks like teeth, but they're really eyes, and that is freaky and weird. And it kind of hits on what you just said. Like, this is an indescribable horror. Like, who thinks of these things? Well, obviously there are guys in Japan sitting in front of computers drawing them, so they're thinking of them, but it's made to be so terrifying that it drives you crazy. And some of the monsters and cat, if you keep playing the end of Bloodborne, you're going to run into monsters where this actually happens, where they get a hold of you, you frenzy, and you lose most of your health because you're going insane. And that's a, I guess the most realistic way, of, of handling a situation like that. If I would see a walking giant brain with teeth, I'd probably go a little nuts too.
And I think it's not even, like, a part of the game system sometimes, where they will create something that is so visually intimidating and just visually incomprehensible that you will have to fight it a few times to even understand what it is and, like, what it can do to you.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
Sort of getting back to place and setting and what makes From so good at it. I think part of it is their use of silence, because most of their games have very little music, and that really invokes a sort of terrifying feeling of loneliness that a lot of other video games just don't do. Like especially most AAA games, not constant sound, but there's constantly at least a low murmur of music in almost every video game that you'll play. But the From stuff uses silence and sound design very, very effectively. So when music actually comes up, you know that you're sort of in the shit at that moment. Something's about to go down. And I had just recently played Lords of the Fallen, finally. And it's a very earnest Dark Souls ripoff, but it's absolutely a Dark Souls ripoff. But as I was playing, I mean, the mechanics are really similar, but like the setting and the tone, and it's felt totally like Dark Souls for the Gears of War set, with just
It is a very dude bro.
Big screaming like, bald guys, and
your hero is just a bald space marine kind of type.
Yeah, in like Warcraft armor with huge shoulders and huge hands, and like the music was constantly in the background, and like there's just a steady stream of dialogue and just grunting and screaming. I give them credit for really taking a shot at making a game like that, but it just doesn't evoke that sort of quiet terror that the From guys have, and Miyazaki specifically, have really figured out.
Well, this is a question that we've come to a few times. Bloodborne is kind of going by the wayside at the end of the year. We're going to get Dark Souls 3 at the beginning of the year. It's strictly speaking, Bloodborne's not part of the Dark Souls series, but it is part of kind of the overall, I guess, milieu, the franchise, whatever you want to call it. How do you guys feel about the fact that we're officially in annual release territory?
Oh, well, I feel like, I don't know how, maybe just no one is sleeping or whatever, but they've been able to succeed despite the scheduling of their game releases. Like, as much as I criticize Assassin's Creed and other games like Call of Duty for being annual, I don't know if they're just playing it safe or it really is that difficult to, you know, try to change things up. But From Software just has never let me down. Even if people hate Dark Souls 2, I still love it. I've yet to play something from them that felt like undercooked or I'm sorry, I'm at a loss for words here, but I've yet to play something from them that disappointed me since Demon's Souls.
I think we need to address, maybe this isn't the place for it, but I think we should address the Dark Souls 2 hate. Like, I saw that in the comments when you wrote that.
Oh,
when you
yeah.
wrote that article. Like, what the hell, people?
I don't get it. I don't get it.
I like the first game better, and if I'm being honest, I think Demon's Souls is probably my favorite of all of them, but Dark Souls 2 is it's the friendliest, from a mechanical standpoint, it's the best experience, and it's, even if you don't like, excuse me, how they've sort of taken out some things that made the previous games difficult, like item weight and the way that forging happens or whatever, that doesn't really take away ultimately from the game. Just because you got to drop stuff off at once an hour or something like that at a stockpile guy doesn't necessarily make the game worse. I don't get it.
I feel like with Dark Souls 2, it is a fallacy in that they are giving one guy all the credit, or too much credit, rather, because Miyazaki is very important to the overall Dark Souls universe and how the games feel, and he did have a supervisory role.
The gaming landscape now. I mean, that was
of course.
He's like the messiah.
And he was a supervisor on Dark Souls 2, but I feel like we, the people who are really responsible for things we like the most, we don't know their names, and we probably never will.
Yeah.
Like, Resident Evil 4 is one of my favorite games of all time, and it's not just Shinji Mikami. I was looking at recently all of the people who worked on that game, and they're all at Platinum Games now. So it's like, no wonder I like Platinum Games. They all worked on my favorite game of all time, almost, so... It's not just Mikami, it's not just Miyazaki. They're very important, but there are people that we don't realize are making a lot of these choices that will never get credit, or, I mean, they'll get credit, but we just won't know their names.
Well, before we wrap up, I have a game to recommend to you guys. that you should check out. And
I hope it's not 60 hours long, because I've got a lot of those right now.
More like 10 hours.
Okay, that's perfect.
It's, strictly speaking, I guess, maybe not an RPG. It's a tactics game. It came out yesterday.
Oh, I know what this is. I saw you playing it. Yeah.
It's called SteamWorld Heist, and it's outstanding. It's not anything like SteamWorld Dig. It's a spiritual successor, and it has pretty much everything that I could ever want in a game. It has robots. It's in space. It's turn-based. It's a lot like XCOM, and it has a really distinct and fun and personality-filled art style. I think it's actually one of the best 3DS games of the year. It's certainly one of the best tactics games of the year. And you can read my review over on US Gamer, but suffice it to say, I really, really like it. If you're looking for RPG elements, there are actually a fair number. Your characters do level up. They do progress. They have certain abilities that give them a role in the party. You build up a party of up to four characters that you can bring on to a given mission, and they all fill specific roles like leader, tank, that kind of thing. There's a lot of weapons. I was kind of worried that there wouldn't be enough variety to it, but it works really, really well. And at right now, $16.99, not a bad value for a game that could keep you busy for between 20 and 30 hours. I think it's fantastic. So I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to talk about it again, but it's definitely going on my top 10 games of the year list. So check it out, SteamWorld Heist. And let's wrap this thing up. You can find Acts of the Blood God, as always, on iTunes and on Stitcher. Please leave a review. We're going to keep reading mailbag questions and that sort of thing. Over on US Gamer, we're wrapping up our 2015. We're doing our 2015 in review. And next week, we are going to be kicking off the first part of our year in review in RPGs on Acts of the Blood God, mostly bringing back all of the guests that I've had on over the past year and asking them the pertinent question, what was your favorite RPG? I'm sure that we're going to get nice wide variety of responses, and I guess you're gonna have to wait to find out what my favorite RPG was. Maybe SteamWorld Heist if you wanna do that. But in any case, guys, do you have anything to plug, John?
Nothing really to plug. I suppose you can follow me on Twitter and be disappointed because I don't really tweet too much. But I'm at John_Learned.
Excellent. And Bob?
Oh, yeah. I am a content creator and making too much content. So you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. Of course, I also co-host the podcast Retronauts. You can find that at retronauts.com and usgamer.net every week. And I also, this is not video game related, but you might care about it. It's the podcast Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of the Simpsons. We're currently in season 2, and you can find that on lasertimepodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. I'm sorry, it's been a long day.
Speaking of Laser Time, I was just on Laser Time.
Yeah.
I did a big episode about the Star Wars Expanded Universe, which I know way, 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 way too much about. So,
yeah, Kat, that gave me a real insight into your childhood, that episode.
You mean the fact that I was lonely and deprived and obsessive
yes.
and nerdy?
I obsessed over different things, and they come out in different ways, but I totally like identified, like, oh, that's what Kat was into, okay.
Yeah, pretty much. So go listen to me talk about Star Wars books for an hour and a half or so. I think you'll like it. And also, I was also on Retronauts recently, so... And it was definitely JRPG related, so I'm not going to spoil it, but...
That will come out in February, I think.
We were originally going to tackle, a couple of topics, but the first topic ended up being so big that we had to basically...
That'll
be
out
like,
really soon, actually. Yeah, that should be out before the new year.
Oh, well, excellent. So you can look forward to it. Yeah.
Those are my favorite Retronauts episodes when, like, you guys, like, take when, like, a larger topic becomes a smaller topic, but you guys are just so into it that it's the insane amount of depth. Those are the Retronauts episodes I love the most.
Oh, cool. Thank you. There's going to be a lot of those soon. We just recorded an entire 3 months worth of Retronauts over the last weekend. So get ready, everybody.
Final note. I am playing Legend of Heroes Trails of Cold Steel, so I will probably have lots of thoughts about that game relatively soon, as soon as I can make an episode about it. It may not be till the new year, but at the very least, I wouldn't mind getting somebody from XSEED on the show to talk about it. But until then, we'll be back next week. And for Bob and John and myself, we'll see you next week. And until then, happy adventuring.